Universität Hamburg.
The publication of Andrzej Sapkowski's debut short story, The Witcher, in 1986, which gave rise to the famous Witcher saga, was seen by Polish critics as a welcome sign in the development of Polish fantasy. And here is basic information on Sapkowski's output. Despite the initial enthusiasm, the characteristic eclecticism permeating Sapkowski's fiction has been viewed by Polish critics with suspicion, if not with sarcastic contempt. And here is the exemplification of such criticism, Magdalena Roszczynialska, a Polish critic of popular culture. Still, as we claim, Sapkowski's intertextual strategy does not detract from the potential of the saga to engage the knowledge and worldviews of the audience, as it can be productive of much more than the mere enjoyment of deciphering a variety of allusions. The very investigation of this potential becomes legitimate in the light of Brian Atterbury's concept of contemporary fantasy as a postmodern genre subverting cultural heritage and constituting, as Brian Atterbury puts it, a mix of history, legend, and literary sources that generates a narrative of seemingly inexhaustible fertility, end of quote. As Atterbury explains, one of the most salient aspects of fantasy fiction is, quote, the cultural work performed by the genre consisting in the archaeological discovery and recycling of traditional stories, similar to a characteristic postmodern practice of what he calls a return to early narrative forms, but with an awareness of their artificiality, end of quote. In this sense, fantasy becomes a form of cultural criticism, quote, an acknowledgement that the great cultural narratives that shape the world are, after all, texts, end of quote. And it's through resurrected and reapplied stories that we can learn about, as Atterbury puts it, those parts of ourselves that defy any other means of analysis. As Atterbury concludes, quote, the storytellers of our own particular tribe, that is fantasy writers, or writers of fantasy, also need to indulge in a playful attitude, a combinatorial game that may take on preconscious content and give it voice, end of quote. Hence, the eclecticism permeating Sapkowski's fiction does not consist in entertainment for its own sake, but rather in the common goal of the reader and the writer to search for answers to burning and challenging questions.
Yes, and it is this Atterbury's affirmative view on the intertextuality in fantasy that has encouraged us to consider the similarities between the protagonist created by Goethe, whom we are going to call the Earl King throughout this presentation, and the character created by Sapkowski, whose name is Oberon, but who's also called the Older King, and that's how we're going to refer to him in order to distinguish between those two, not to mix them, not to confuse them. And specifically, we are interested in the fact that both those characters reflect, in some ways, the concept of otherness. However, the actual realization of the function of the other by each of those two is the source of significant differences between them. While the original Earl King can easily be inscribed in the discourse of otherness, Oberon, this is the older king, responds better to the concept of anotherness, as postulated by Patrick D. Murphy in his Literature, Nature and Other, Ecofeminist Critiques. Murphy's idea relies on shifting the focus on the other from their opposition to the self to their right to equality and partnership, which turns the other into another, and stresses a mutual dependence between them and the self, who also becomes an another in that ecologically motivated network of coexistence. Sapkowski's play with the Earl King's trope does not only reflect the process of transformation from the other to the another, but also underlines several surprisingly controversial aspects of that process. One such aspect is the question of the acceptance of the other, not only together with their differences, but also with their virtues and, most interestingly, their flaws. Thus, the conclusive question provoked by this juxtaposition of the Earl King and the Older King is as follows. Is the other to deserve being granted the status of another, or should they be accepted as they are, even if such an acceptance forces the self to face up to some difficult truths? Murphy mentions such typical features of the other as, quote, permanent incompleteness and prematurity, communicative incommensurability, and binary constructs, end of quote. According to Christopher Gibbs, the otherness of Goethe's Earl King can be described in terms of binary oppositions do, and such binary oppositions would be, quote, the father and son, male and female, life and death, or natural and fantastic, end of quote. And the power of the Euro King's otherness lies in its liminality. Rosemary Jackson, in Fantasy Literature of Subversion, refers to Goethe himself to underline the amoral character of such borderline fantastic imagery in Romanticism. And you can see Goethe on the screen. Right? While Jackson herself concludes that, quote, otherness is all that threatens this world, this real world, with dissolution. And it is this opposition which lies behind the several myths which have developed in the modern fantastic, end of quote. Goethe's Erl King grasps the essence of otherness as defined above, while Sapkowski's older king confirms the lasting importance of that theme for the contemporary fantasy. According to Gibbs, quote, by containing the opposing poles without reconciling them, his, that is the Erl King's, presence leaves the disturbing tensions unresolved and indeed calls the resolution into question. The appearance of the Erl King unsettles not because it bridges oppositions, but because it dismantles them, end of quote. The full identification of the Erl King's otherness must also take into account Franz Schubert's musical interpretation of Goethe's poem. For Gibbs, it is actually Schubert's composition that reveals the Erl King's in-between status, undermining contradictions and disturbing the ontological balance. The crucial factor producing such an effect is the boldly emphasized erotic lust of the supernatural creature for the terrified boy, reflected by the voluptuous character of Schubert's music. Sapkowski's older king, while similar in his otherness to the original Erl King, is pushed even further in this apparently humanizing direction designated by Schubert, drifting away from the other as a fully functional figure of difference towards an another who interacts with the human child on the growingly equal terms. Sapkowski's older king becomes a figure of an imperfect anotherness. This another is in some ways tamed and deprived on the uncanny quality, but simultaneously unable to develop a productive relationship, despite the efforts of both himself and the human, who in this case is a teenage girl, Ciri. And the development of the relationship between those two characters is presented very briefly on your handouts.
The race of elves, as such, is a natural part of Ciri's universe. Therefore, the older king's fairy origin does not make him a supernatural creature. Still, the way his motif is handled by the author, from the overt references to Goethe's ballad to building up the ominous atmosphere of mystery around Ciri and turning the older people into the carriers of its denouement, preserves the disturbing aura usually connected with encountering the other. The first appearance of the phrase "older king" in Sapkowski's saga takes place a long time before the heroine actually meets the otherworldly elves. So one evening, when Ciri, at that time in her early teens, is galloping down an alder and willow-surrounded road at night, her imagination starts to play tricks on her, and at one point it comes to her mind that the trees are in fact the older king's servants. It leaves an impression as if the older king were a commonly known folklore or fairy tale character likely to emerge from the subconsciousness of a terrified child facing scary surroundings. Soon it turns out that Ciri is indeed being chased by the older king's servants, who are not able to fully cross the boundary between the worlds, but sometimes raid on the human universe as wraiths. Thus, the first reference to older king and the actual, albeit unacknowledged, manifestation of his presence does not only produce an atmosphere of supernatural horror, but strongly resembles the situation familiar to the reader from Goethe's poem. The unfolding of Oberon's identity and the story behind Ciri's magical gift gradually shifts the connection between them away from that initial scene of uncanny terror towards a more balanced and rationalized relationship. Ciri's interactions with Oberon develop on the basis of sexual tension, which is also present, or at least strongly suggested, in Goethe's poem. While there are prominent differences in the character of the erotic motif, the Erl King probably acting out of purely hedonistic reasons, and the older king aiming at a pregnancy-resulting intercourse, what seems to link their attitudes is the element of violence. The Erl King's declaration, excuse my German, pronunciation. Ich liebe dich, mich reizt deine schöne Gestalt und bist du nicht willig, so brauch ich Gewalt, quoted by Sapkowski as a motto preceding the chapter that describes Stewart's stay in the older people's world, fully reveals his wooing tactics. The fate awaiting Ciri among the older people is similar to the predicament of Goethe's boy. In that, should her courteous meetings with Oberon prove unsuccessful, the conception is to be executed maybe not exactly by force, but by means of an operation in laboratory conditions. And the likelihood of such a development increases with every encounter between the Ciri and the Elf King due to his failing sexual performance. Sounds a bit like soap opera. Even though Sapkowski's older king gradually loses his uncanny status and reveals himself as an imperfect creature prone to weakness, he reflects all binary oppositions underlined by Gibbs as building up Goethe's protagonist. So Oberon is both an entity from another world and a flesh and bone creature. He's almost immortal, yet marked by death because of a genocide he committed long ago. And finally, surrendering to death himself, he does not survive the encounter with Ciri and passes away, having overdosed a medicament which was probably supposed to improve his sexual capacity. He's gentle and courteous towards the girl, but his actions aim at the nearly total control over her. And finally, mysterious and distant as he is, he wishes to reunite with Ciri on the most intimate ground of physical love. Moreover, it's on that ground that he proves both very powerful and impotent in the very literal sense. Oberon fails to possess the human child the way the original Elf King does, and a possible reason for this situation is that where the Elf King acts with desire, Oberon acts with disgust, as he perceives Ciri, quote from Sapkowski, as a pearl in the swine dung, a brilliant on the finger of a rotting corpse, end of quote. The last paradoxical attribute of the older king, though not related directly to his interaction with Ciri, is that he can be seen both as a victimizer and a victim, though the latter becomes apparent if Oberon is considered in terms of a metonymy for the whole race of elves, rather than a standalone creature. In Sapkowski's universe, elves form the two tribes called the People of the Hills and the Older People. The role of the victimizer can be ascribed to Oberon personally, because the Older People tribe was formed by the part of the elf race, which a long time ago followed his lead, and having opened a passage to another world, destroyed all aboriginal humans there, thereby creating a perfect elf-dominated realm. The position of the victimized, on the other hand, can be referred first of all to the people of the hills, that is, the elves who stayed in the original universe and came to suffer the increasing marginalization on the part of the humans, which has resulted in an open war. In other words, while one branch of the elf race is rapidly losing chances for a harmonious coexistence with humanity, its other branch, the older people, has already victoriously gone through a similar rivalry over the existential space in a different universe. Nevertheless, the older people do emphasize the loyalty towards the extinction-facing brothers and sisters. They also point to the necessity of opening the interworld passage once again in order to save the people of the hills as the crucial justification of the striving to possess Ciri's power.
Okay, and so here you can see this graphic representation of those complex relationships between the humans and the elves in the two respective worlds of the novel, Ciri's world and Oberon's world. I hope this representation is more or less clear, or should we explain something? Okay. So it can easily be seen that this interracial conflict in the Witcher saga has much in common with the ethnically motivated oppression and discrimination familiar to the readers from the contemporary reality. However, while the overall situation of the elves, and specifically the people of the hills, brings to mind the fate of the real-world ethnic groups which have once faced the expansion of the Eurocentric civilization, the older people, with their dark past, disturb that analogy, as the roles of the victimizers and the victimized are reversed by the border between the worlds. In Ciri's reality, the former, that is, the victimizers, are the humans, and the victims are the elves, and in Oberon's reality, it is the other way around. Hence, although the Elder King's gradual movement from the role to the other towards a position providing a ground for dialogue appears beneficial in terms of the coexistence-inducing anotherness, it is simultaneously facilitated by overtly negative factors. The crucial aspect of this problematic process is the moral degradation of the elves, or, in our opinion, more accurately, the shared entanglement of the elf and the human race in a vicious circle of mutual violence and harm. In this light, the relationship between both races should be considered in terms of symbolic balance rather than symbolic justice. As we see it, treating the overall picture of the guilt distribution between the humans and the elves, first of all, as a manifestation of interconnectedness, is not only more productive, but also closer to the spirit of Sapkowski's novel in general, as reflected by the following quotation. So this is a dialogue between an elf and a human who were involved in the war between their two races and now are commenting on the results of that war in a quite a peaceful conversation. The world has changed. Justice has prevailed. This is uttered by a third party, by a third person present. Well, the justice part sounds like an exaggeration. The pilgrim smiled a little, the pilgrim that is the human. I would, however, agree that the world seems to have adjusted itself to the basic law of physics. I wonder, drawled the elf, if we're thinking about the same law. Every action, the pilgrim said, causes a reaction. The elf snorted, but it was a rather good natured sound. Touché, human. So the replacement of a moral perspective with one relying on the rules of nature provides a welcoming ground for the category of anotherness. With reference to elves and humans, it enables the conclusion that both races become an another in their mutual relationship. What, however, grants them the equal status is, first of all, the common imprisonment in the spiderweb of violence, hurt, and guilt. As presented above, the older king's metamorphosis from the other to an another turns out to be not only complex, but also controversial and disturbing. He ceases to personify an unknown powerful danger and becomes a source of serious emotional frustration instead. He loses the uncanny aura and fails to regain his power. Finally, he demonstrates that the common denominator between the self and the other may take an uncomfortable form of something not at all coexistence supporting, for instance, being prone to racially motivated mass murders. In the light of the undisputedly pessimistic picture of the older king as a flawed another, a question may be posed why to analyze that character through the lens of anotherness and thus undermine the notion's productive potential. The depiction of Oberon as the other, not as the other, but as another, rendered as such precisely by his imperfections, helplessness, and the moral load of unquestionable guilt, produces a disquieting aura and challenge for the reader to share that faulty identity. While on the level on individual relation between the older king and Ciri, the mutuality of the burden is not obvious, although it is present. We can argue it is present in the novel, but it would require another analysis on our part, so we skip that part. That mutuality becomes clear in the relation between the elf and human race in general. Therefore, in an attempt to answer the question we posed at the beginning of the presentation, we might conclude that it is not so much the other who should earn the participation in the network of anotherness as the self who should use this network to recognize their own imperfections. And that's it. Thank you.